Here's my wife's review. It's a one-sentence review of the movie Skyscraper. It makes me hate being awake.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for October 2019. I am your host, Jonathan Buchan, and I'm joined once again by the Mongolian Grill Master, Tim Nelson. Because if you ever have the chance to go to a Mongolian Grill, you want to go with Tim, because Tim treats it like his own personal kitchen. It's got just the right amount of sauces with just the right vegetables, and it is gourmet. I love it.
And I give three Mongol facts.
Yeah?
But you got to come with us if you want to know what they are. Dave McDonald's tired of them. As is probably right. Everyone else, but Dave was willing to let me know.
Your dishes were a work of art, and I tasted one of them, and it was amazing.
I'm telling you, I know what I'm doing with Mongolian Grill.
Yes, and this is, of course, because it's October, and that means that myself, Tim, Cinema Faith co-founder Dan Baker, and favorite listener of the pod, Dave McDonald, all go out for dinner and a movie. We do this once a year. This is our second annual dinner and a movie in October, and so we go see like the latest Hollywood release, and then we go to Mongolian Barbecue, and it was awesome, Tim. We came, we conquered. It was great.
It was pretty amazing.
Gluttony of the highest order.
It's like a big circle.
Tim and I are always the last ones up. We're always like, we're going to go get one more, and they're like, nope, they tap out, and you and me go and get our final round.
They're big guys, and they're tapping out.
I know.
You think like you go to the Mongolian Grill.
It's all you can eat.
It's all you care to eat. Yes, it's all you can eat, but no doggy bags, folks.
No.
But you go to the Mongolian Grill, and the you would assume that, okay, if you're 25, you might go up 9 times. I get that.
Yeah.
And maybe you're 35, you might go up 8 times.
4, yeah.
4 times. But apparently the guys that we were with, besides us, tapped out at how many times? 2?
I think 2. Yeah.
2.
Just done. Done. Couldn't even muster one more trip. And that's happened twice in a row.
That was weak. I don't know. I think next time we're going to have to put like a 3-trip minimum on the,
this is
on
the requirement
experience.
To come.
Girl, if you really think John's birthday should be happy, then you have to.
Yes.
Go to the grill 3 times.
I approve of this.
And also, you have to make him, you should make him eat 1 time with that fish.
Oh my gosh.
That was nasty.
What's crazy though is every year I worry that there's not going to be a good October movie. You know, we've only done it 2 years, so it's not like but still, like every year there's always seems to be one good movie that comes out at the beginning of October. There was Blade Runner 2049 that one time, and then
was
there was
good.
This movie, which
was
is
there,
a what?
Was there It? No.
It no. We saw that. That was I think that was last October, but you know what? We didn't do it last October anyway. It doesn't matter. The point is,
okay then.
This year we had another great movie, and that was Joker, and that is what we saw for our annual dinner and a movie, and it was great, and we are going to give you our unbridled, unfiltered reactions to Joker.
Wild horses, baby.
But first, we have to address 2 things. 1, Tim, this is officially our 50th Cinema Faith podcast.
What?
I know. Cue the champagne, cue the music, we did it. Slight caveat, though. I was the only one doing these for like the first 10, maybe. So
holy heck.
It's not the 50th of you and me, but that was back when I had no idea what I was doing. The sound quality was absolutely terrible. I even deleted like recently the first like couple because it was like beyond the pale. Like literally, I was using this headset and you could hear like it clicking. Okay.
But people might like that vintage
right.
Cinema Faith podcast.
Right. Well, they could still get it.
It's like watching old movies of like World War I or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's still a couple with just me where I ramble for like 2 hours, just my voice. I'm sure everyone's lining up to go to that. But you can go back to our first ever podcast, which was Birdman.
Oh,
that
yeah.
was the first one you and I did. And so that is, so I, if you want to go be a completist with the Tim and John version, you can go back to Birdman. Sound quality still not great there. We were like, because I didn't quite figure out how at that point to level out the volume. So what happened is you would laugh and it would people's earbuds would blow up and then it would get really quiet. But thankfully, since then, I gained a suite of tools, Tim. But back then, it's a little rough. But still, that's Birdman's our first podcast.
You're not selling this. It's a good podcast.
I know. It is.
Actually.
It is. It's good. It's
I'm
good.
Very
and,
loud.
And the chemistry was there from minute one between you and me. And I'm really grateful for that.
Yes.
And so, Tim, I just want to say, on our 50th podcast, I love doing this with you. I really do. And thank you for doing this every month, man. This is so great.
Do you remember when we first fell in podcast love?
Yes.
Let's talk about it.
Okay.
Here on the 50th anniversary of you podcasting and the 41 or something of
me. Yeah.
So I remember that we went and saw a film, and this was years ago, and we just like basically talked a ton about the film.
Yes.
I don't even remember. Do you remember what it was?
I don't remember what it was, but I remember that. Yeah.
And we spent like an hour talking about the film at the end. Yeah. And then we didn't put two and two together, and I kept trying to write articles, and I'm like, oh, that's not my thing. And I can write an article. I was just, I wanted it to be really good.
Yeah.
And,
no, that's so true. The first, before I had the idea of the podcast, I was like, Tim, please be one of my monthly contributors. And so every time I would see Tim, I was like, how's the article going? And every time he would be like, deer in the heads, like, let's, like, not happening. And so I realized quickly that that's never going to happen. And then, ding, podcast.
See, John knew my limitations before I knew my own.
Yeah.
And then he's like, no. You like to talk a big game and not back it up. But see, in podcasting, you can talk a big game and that is backing it up.
Exactly.
See, look at that.
And you're an external processor. So like this is the perfect format where you can just sort of talk something out.
Yeah.
And,
leave the writing to all the introverts. I'll do the talking, you know?
Yes.
All right.
What I remember most.
Introverts that all are listening on your treadmill.
I know.
I don't want to be offending all, you know. Half of the world.
I just remember for some reason I can only remember just how bumpy the technical side of things have been. Like I remember when we were doing double tracks and there was like this echo. And so remember when I bought those like gate things? So we would literally have these things in front of our faces where I could only see your eyes because there was like this big shield in front of your face.
It was
and,
like we were wearing like riot gear to podcast in.
Yeah.
And you remember when you were like, do you have any blankets?
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about, John?
We tried to soundproof the whole room and
I was there were blankets all over the room.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely bizarre.
Making it up as we go. That's what this whole journey has been.
You're like, that surface looks a little bit too hard. And I'm like, what? It's called a wall. You're like, yeah, you're gonna have to soften that up a bit.
But we found the perfect combo and now we've got it, man. We're in the groove. But that's okay. That's how it goes. And it's been a fun ride. And here's the 50 more, I say.
Oh man, this is great.
All right, second thing, Tim, before we get to Joker is, of course, everyone's favorite segment, and I hear a little birdie told me that you have actually something to talk about this time. Tim, what have you been watching?
There is a movie I did watch on HBO. Yes, I listened to you, John, and I did add a little bit of HBO to my Prime. I know!
I love it.
You were right. You influenced me to spend money. And I watched Peter Jackson... Have you seen
heard
this?
Good things about this.
Yeah, it's his. He basically took a bunch of. It's called "They Shall Not Perish." Is that what it's called?
Something like that. Is it? Yeah, kind of makes eccentric title, but yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's from Revelation, right? Or is it from Isaiah? I can't remember. Any case, he takes this World War I footage and he takes World War I documentaries, and he basically goes to each of the places where these things were filmed, and he does like color analysis.
Wow.
Of the place. At the time of year where it was shot, because they have a lot of that,
mm-hmm.
and they recolor all this World War I footage, and he does no like bland like historian narration that you're so used to on the History Channel, where somebody's like, "Yeah, man, aliens are real." It's more like the actual interviews that were recorded in the 60s, 70s, 80s of World War I veterans talking about World War I.
So it's literally just like slices of footage that he's restored that just look.
Yeah,
totally modern.
So, like, you know, I'm a history political science major. They call that primary source.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, he's tinkered with the technology, but mm-hmm. like, there is no narrator. It's just straight up.
That's incredible.
World War I vets.
Wow.
Yeah, it's haunting, man. I mean, I tell you, like, you said, it's violent. Not violent, but it is violent, but it shows lots and lots of bodies.
Mm.
So apparently, they don't have any battle footage from World War I.
Really?
Yeah, it's because the cameras were too difficult to operate
mm-hmm.
and also like be in a battle.
But you see the aftermath of it.
You see aftermath, you see training, you see the trench life, you see before. There's a few scenes where it's kind of like battles. You see just stuff that is kind of amazing. And he does a reverse Wizard of Oz, which I'll just... Everybody, you know, you just see it. You'll see it.
Okay.
And what he does is he takes when they have all the training photos, all the training video part,
mm-hmm.
and it's all black and white. And as soon as they hit the actual trenches, he turns everything into color. And it's like
that's
basically
powerful.
Instead of when they enter Oz, it's like when they enter hell. It turns into full color. Crazy.
Dude, that's so
highly
cool.
Recommend it. That's my, I don't know, that's a 2018. I don't know if it
mm-hmm.
was in
that was last year. Yeah.
Was it in the
It was. Yeah, I remember seeing reviews when it was in theaters, and I like every review I saw was an A, and so I've been meaning it was on my list and I just never got around
was
to it. That's on HBO.
Did it run against the climbing film?
Yeah, I think it was nominated. I'd have to double check that. But yeah, that climbing film actually won, which you were really happy about because you called it.
I just thought this is incredible.
Yeah. Well, good. There you go. That is Tim's recommendation. Check it out on HBO. And of course, you still have to check out Chernobyl now that you have your subscription.
I started watching Chernobyl. Yes.
You did. I'm so happy.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to watch.
It's haunting. I know.
Don't pick up the graphite.
No. That first episode is crazy.
Oh, it's so horrible.
I know. All right. So I am actually going through a show on HBO's chief rival, Showtime.
Oh, no.
And I know. So I've swung over there and I'm watching Escape at Dannemora. This is a show based on a real life prison escape, and it stars Benicio del Toro from Traffic and other movies. Paul Dano, who was, he was the preacher
Little
guy
Miss Sunshine,
in Little Miss Sunshine and There Will Be Blood. Yeah, right.
God, he's freaky in that movie.
I know. And he's really good in this too. And then Patricia Arquette, who they actually put a ton of makeup on to look really wrinkly and older than she normally is.
She's in
is.
Everything, right?
She was in Boyhood, and yeah, she's a really good actress. So there's those three leads, and this movie is about a real life prison escape. Now I'm only two episodes in, so they're just setting the table. Ben Stiller is the director of this thing, and it's only seven episodes. It's like it's a mini series, like part one, part two. So it's not like the show that's going to keep going, but it's really good so
what
far.
What is the name of that in the Emmys? Something format.
I mean, I think it's still up.
Series or something?
You're right, because Chernobyl won that. It was like best limited series or something like that. Chernobyl won the Emmy for that just recently. Yeah. So anyway, Escape at Dannemora, Ben Stiller, who is an underrated director. He really is. He's done like Tropic Thunder. He's really good. He's really talented. But this is a straight up drama, and I'm only two episodes in, like I said. So I don't know if it like stays good. But right now I'm in that stage, you know, that streaming stage where you're like looking forward to the fact that
the honeymoon period.
Yeah, no, there's that period where like you are knee deep in a show, and you know that at some point later tonight you're going to be having that drink and the snacks, and you're going to be clicking play on the next episode, and you like literally are looking forward to it.
Yes,
that's
I
where
know
I
what
am.
You're talking about the dopamine's flowing.
Yes, that's the streaming revolution, Tim, and I'm all the way in.
You're a drug addict. I understand that. I'm with you. I felt that way before.
So there you go. I'll report back how it all shakes out. But two episodes in, I highly recommend Escape at Dannemora. All right, man. Here we go. Preamble's out of the way. It's time to dive into the belly of the beast. We're going to talk about Joker. So on our last show, we did Booksmart. And we said there was we kind of ran out of things to talk about. Remember, we literally hit a wall and it was like, literally, we've already added everything we possibly can to this movie that is not worth talking about very much. But this time, I think we have the opposite problem because there is a ton to talk about with Joker. So buckle up, folks. This episode could be on the longer side. But if you go on film Twitter or Facebook, like everyone's talking about this movie. They're arguing about it. They're praising it and hating it. So hopefully you won't mind us getting into the weeds on this one because everyone else is. So
they're in the weeds.
They're in the weeds. So going into Saturday and watching this movie, I was really excited for two reasons. One, anytime that you take a genre film and you add a new something into it, right? So in this case, you have this character, this comic book character we're all familiar with, the Joker, and then you add one of the best actors working today, Joaquin Phoenix, and you make it an R-rated movie, which is very unusual for anything in the Marvel DC universe. That automatically gets me intrigued. And then you factor in the hype that started pouring in from these early screenings. A ton of people loved it. I think we talked about before that it won the Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival.
Yeah.
Highest honor. Roma won it last year. Tim's favorite movie of last year. And what's actually even more intriguing than that was how polarizing the reception to this thing was. Like, if you go on Rotten Tomatoes, you can do this right now. Go on Rotten Tomatoes and they'll have like the grade of all the critics. And you go down the list. I have never seen such a widespread of grades. So it'll be like A, C, B plus, A, D, F. F. Literally, there was one critic that refused to give it any ratings because he thought it was morally deplorable and that it should never have been made.
That was crazy.
So literally, that's the range from best movie of the year to should never have been made. And that made me really want to see this thing for myself. So that's where I was going into it. Tim, What were you going into? What was it going on through your mind? I know you don't typically love comic book movies in general.
So it was a really sophisticated analysis. No, it was, John wants to go to this. It's John's birthday. I go to the Joker movie now.
You just dragged along because it was my birthday. Okay, I
was like, I'm going to have I'm going to define the parking. And then you told me we were going to watch 70 mil, and that started getting me excited because I love the format.
Yep.
And then it was at our local, like, theater where our film festival is,
place we love.
That got me excited.
Yep.
And because they got good popcorn, and then Dave was going to be there, and I know Dave would have some opinions, and it would be really interesting. So I was beginning to get pumped up on it. I didn't know what it would be. I didn't I haven't like let anything influence me. I'm just going to be straight from the heart on this one, guys.
Awesome. And you're right. It was actually the only theater in our whole state that was showing it in 70 millimeter. But I have to say, our last 70 millimeter film that I saw with you, and I don't know if you've seen any in between this, was Tarantino's Hateful Eight. That came around on this like road show thing. I still have the booklet.
That's so cool. Booklet. It's probably worth something.
I know.
Yeah.
But that to me was like an amazing, that was the first time I had seen true 70 millimeter. I also saw it with Dunkirk, and there's something about it that was like vibrant and the colors and everything. But this print really didn't seem that special. And I don't know what it was. Did you think that too?
Yeah, it didn't. So it was either, it could have been a couple things we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if we're not experts, but it seemed either like the projector wasn't bright enough
because
I wasn't picking up detail like I was picking up detail in the other ones.
Yes.
Or that it's so big, the theater that we were in, that it didn't really matter that it was in 70 because it's going to be dwarfed no matter what.
It was a huge theater. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it could also just be the quality control aspect because, I mean, I'm sure Tarantino, like this is a guess, but I'm sure Tarantino has like detailed instructions. Maybe even the studio like, you know, goes out and checks things. So that could be it too, where you just have maybe the quality control wasn't as strict with this one. I don't know. But either way, yeah, it kind of just looked more like an old 35 millimeter that I would watch when I was a kid.
Like trapezoidy looking.
Uh-huh. It was a little jittery.
Yeah, they didn't hang it correctly. It was just like...
I know.
I was a little disappointed because, you know, I guess we got a matinee price. So that was not so bad.
We got a good price on it.
But like, if you're going to say it's 70, do a good job with it.
100%.
So that's I rarely have a critique because it's this beautiful movie house near the lake.
It is.
And they don't screw up a lot of stuff. They do a good job on almost everything.
100%.
And so for me, I was a little bit disappointed because they have such a reputation. I mean, everything is good there. From the popcorn down to the sound. I mean, everything, detail.
And it's like rooted in history. You've got all these. Yeah, totally.
And so that was just weird. It wasn't like them.
Yep. That's it. But as for the movie itself, let's get to the plot first. Tim, you were so good at describing the plot of Booksmart. I'm going to put you on the spot. You got to do us the honors again.
Really? This is a more complicated movie, John.
It is. I mean, it isn't. Well, how would you describe to someone who has no idea what we're talking about, my mom, what Joker's about?
I'm talking to your mom now. Good to meet you, Ms. Butrin.
Yeah.
I'm a friend of your son's. You've never met me. Actually, I think you met your mom once.
Once, yeah.
So anyway, what I would say is this. It's a film about a chaotic time, 1981. Mm-hmm. That's its setting in Gotham. A large city, not unlike New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles.
Fictional city, but
fictional
very
city. We're
similar
familiar
to that.
With it. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy time where the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and one man has deep loyalty to his mother, and he is a clown by day and a joker by night.
Wow.
This is a film about a man who has been cast away by our systems to languish and rot, where he can no longer afford his medications. He can no longer go to counseling. And we will see what happens as he basically runs amok.
Whew,
in his head and in our society.
That was beautiful, man. You're right. It's like we are trapped inside this mind, this Joker's mind. It's a character study, and we're seeing things the way he sees them, and the movie is really like a slow descent into madness.
Madness.
Yes, and we're along for the ride. Wonderful. That's it. All right, Mom, you got it? All right.
Yes, it's not so slow. It's like 2 hours, but
yeah.
But it is a descent into madness.
It is.
Madness.
All right, well, let's talk about the star of the show here, Joaquin Phoenix. So I was thinking back, and I think the first role I remember him in was Gladiator back in 2000. You remember that sucker?
Yeah, he was a jerk.
Yeah. He played that whiny little guy who likes his sister and like kills his dad, and then like just spends the whole movie whining for 3 hours about like, I want to be in charge and no one respects me, and then has that showdown with Russell Crowe back when he was buff and... Yeah, Gladiator.
You changed tone when you talked about Russell.
Hey, back when Russell had abs and it was 2000, I was like, yeah, I wouldn't mind having that look. That
the
physique.
Man's like 60 years old.
I know. Now he's
not Brad Pitt. He can't have abs that
you know,
long.
You're right. He's like probably as old as Brad Pitt, but Brad Pitt still looks so good, and Russell's like totally like
a human.
Gone.
He's like a human.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Totally.
Although I heard he's hard to work with. He may not be a human. I don't know.
Yes.
Oh wait, some
I have heard
are.
That as well. But yeah, that was the year 2000. It was a good performance. He was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. But yeah, definitely plays a whiny creep for 3 hours.
Yes.
But honestly, you'd be hard-pressed to find a single bad performance when you look at this guy's filmography. But what are there any roles that really stand out?
Well, there's like blockbuster roles. Like, wasn't he Johnny Cash?
He was. Walked the Line.
Yeah.
That was probably the thing that brought him into the mainstream.
I'm Johnny Cash. Yeah,
Johnny
Cash.
And he was nominated for Best Actor for that.
Now,
so that
he's related to some other people.
Yeah. He's related to River Phoenix, who had that tragic... In the Viper Room, the club in L.A., he like OD'd. And
in a place like the Viper Room?
It was Johnny Depp's club at the time, and it was a big deal. And I was just reading a recent interview with Joaquin Phoenix, and he said that contrary to a lot of popular opinion, that it wasn't like River Phoenix was a drug addict. It was literally like a situation where he thinks someone handed him a cup that had like a bunch of garbage, and it was just like boom, like that. It was pretty tragic that way. But yeah. So, because he, in Joaquin Phoenix's estimation, River was the kind of guy that, like, didn't like clubs. He was an introvert. He would rather just be, like, at home, like, listening to music and stuff. And so, it was kind of one of those bad situations. But, yeah, it's something that still haunts him and that whole family. Yeah.
And there's another, isn't he related to somebody else, too?
He was related to Casey Affleck by the fact that Casey Affleck was married to his sister, but they have since divorced, and so they haven't spoken in a while. But yeah, for a while, Joaquin and Casey Affleck were very close, and they did that one like faux documentary where Joaquin Phoenix was supposedly a rapper now and quitting film.
But he wasn't.
It was all fake, and they had the public going for a while. The documentary wasn't that great, but like it was called I'm Still Here or something, and it was a fun practical joke they were trying to play on all of us, and
it was creative.
It was
experimental. It was ambitious.
It was.
It was a failure.
Yeah, exactly. There was Signs, M. Night Shyamalan's third movie about aliens. He was in that, and he was
Was he like the brother?
He was the brother who kind of like was funny.
He was great.
He was good in that. He was probably the best thing about that movie, honestly. Yeah, and then he was in The Village and a far worse M. Night Shyamalan movie. This was when Shyamalan was going downhill.
Village.
Did you like The Village? I didn't love it.
You think it's kind of heavy-handed?
Yeah. Right. I mean, it was back when the twist just seemed like he was really reaching, like, got to have that big twist, and I don't know. Shyamalan lost it.
A lot of pressure, man. A lot of pressure.
You know. So, anyway, nominated for 3 Oscars. Like I said, he was nominated for Gladiator, Walk the Line, and his third Oscar that he was nominated for was The Master. That was Paul Thomas Anderson's movie with the late Philip Seymour Hoffman about that, like, kind of Scientology-ish... cult thing. Yeah.
That was a trippy movie, but I did like it.
It was really good. Anything Paul Thomas Anderson does, of course, is good. Boogie Nights and Magnolia. We always talk about Magnolia. But yeah, so he was in that. And Inherent Vice, the other Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
I like
he
that
was
too.
In.
I want to watch that again.
Yep. And then my favorite movie from last year that I've talked about several times, You Were Never Really Here, also stars Joaquin Phoenix, which you keep saying you're going to try to watch
again.
So
here's the thing. It's clear to our listeners at this point that you are no longer an objective observer of Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, that's true.
But indeed a fanboy.
I am. I honestly think he's probably the best actor working today.
Oh, no.
I know.
What happened to Ryan Gosling?
No, it wasn't Ryan Gosling. It was Christian Bale. But I was thinking about this. I liked Christian Bale for the same reasons I like Joaquin Phoenix, in that he's very physical. He transforms himself completely in a role. Joaquin is doing that, and he has a better track record. If you look at the last few Christian Bale movies, I mean, kind of. They're just not as great of material, whereas Joaquin's hitting it out of the park.
So what you're saying is you're in love with Batman and Joker.
Ooh.
Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. I like it. So anyway, he's been in a ton of movies, and he's given a lot of great performances. I really like him as an actor. What do you think of him as an actor? Just like you're not as a fanboyish as I am, of course.
Oh, I like him.
You like him. Yeah. Okay, good.
I'm just not in love with him.
I do have a lot of man crushes that come out on this podcast. It's kind of embarrassing.
All right with me. I just, you know, I want to make you aware of them if you're going to make the world.
You do.
Aware
you always point them out. It's great.
I'm not afraid of them. I'm okay with them. I just want to make sure that you're aware of them. Because the listeners will hear how your voice changes and you go.
It gets a little high pitched.
Yeah, how you lift up one heel when you.
Can we talk about Russell Crowe's abs again? Or are we.
Well, I'm all right. I can do that too. I felt like, you had a lot of love for a lot of men tonight.
Happily married.
And I'm okay with that. I just wanted to make sure that you knew.
That it's happening.
It's occurring. Perfect. And I'm all right with it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So let's transition to him as the Joker. What did you think of him specifically as the Joker? What did he bring to the role? What was his performance like for you?
I liked him.
Yes.
I think, so I'm going to get into a little bit of stuff that, man, I don't know if it's controversial or not, but one of the things I like about Joaquin Phoenix is he has a cleft palate. Have you ever noticed that?
Has
a scar?
I know he has the scar. Is that what that is? Is that the definition of a cleft palate?
I'm pretty sure that's what that is.
Okay.
But it basically gives him like this raw, like a raw edge, like to where he knows about like what it's like to go through something.
Yeah.
Like physically you can see that, right?
Yeah, good point.
You're like, man, that dude has been through something. So he plays it, and that's in all his roles, and he's not like, he just does what he does. It's not like it never gets discussed. Mm-hmm. I I'm not saying like that bring that like, you know, he merited something, but it gives him a certain like edge when it comes to these kind of movies where he's doing a deep profile on a character.
Good point. Yeah.
And it's a physical characteristic. And so to me, like it makes you go, oh, he's been through things and he knows, you know, mm-hmm. he's been through things.
Especially when he's playing really rough characters like this one in last year's.
It's like he's probably, you know, he's been on the playground and had bad things go wrong for him. You know what I mean? With kids being jerks. And so that's not the part of his acting, but it does bring in, it's real.
Kind of like Harrison Ford's like broken nose. It's kind of, there's something
the same,
to that.
Yeah, there's something there that goes, oh yeah, this guy knows about real life. Uh-huh. And so he has that rug, and he has that rugged. And then did he lose a lot of weight?
Yes.
Because we're getting into appearance. I think that's important to this role.
I think it's a physical role.
It is.
Yeah.
And so he loses all this weight, and he is just super gaunt because he's really short to start out with, right?
I don't know if he's short or not.
I think he might be.
Maybe. And so I hope he is.
He's super gaunt. His hair is long and stringy. Uh-huh. And then he looks like he hasn't slept in days.
Yes.
And then he smokes cigarettes to this whole movie, and it's like OCD. The way he smokes cigarettes is like, they're like this cigarette, if I don't smoke this thing fast, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. So he's like just chain smoking the whole movie, and it's just disturbing. But so that's just physical appearance. But the part I would say is like, he is in this role, scary in this role. Like it's a little nervous. I have a hard time watching him.
Yeah.
Because he really embraces the idea of somebody that goes off of eight medications?
Yes. So he looks like it, feels like it.
A lot of mental illness and then gets abandoned by the system and then goes off of eight medications at once.
Bad things are going to happen?
Well, it's like, can you imagine? I was thinking about the podcast even tonight and talking a little bit about this stuff, but like I have a medication. I'm going to let the listeners know that because it's important to talk openly about that. And so like I have ADHD and so I have, and recently said, hey, I'll go on a medication. And obviously my doctor's involved, but if, you know, even like one, like I go off that medication and like, it's like, I'm not right. Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time like even being around people for a little while. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't imagine like if you're a character, or if you're a person that is on eight medications and just having them drop out the bottom and then like trying to do that character. And he does a fantastic job.
That's a really good point.
It's like he's trying his, it gives this feeling like he's trying as hard as he possibly can to do everything right. And it will never work out for him.
Exactly. He's trying to follow all the rules, and everywhere he goes, just keeps getting pushed to the side. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what's trippy about the performance is it looks like he's having external conflict, but a lot of that is internal conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And he hallucinates and he has delusions and all those things. It was just really, but we get his perspective the whole movie.
Yeah, we're inside him, basically. We see what he sees, for better or worse.
And we root for him in some scenarios. Other scenarios are like, oh, this is awful.
Right.
But I think there is some empathy we develop even in the madness.
Totally. I love what you said about the physical aspect to it. He did. He lost a ton of weight, worked with a doctor to lose all that weight. And then what he said in this interview was that what he was surprised to discover was that when he got down to that skinny frame, that there was an agility that he discovered that he didn't think, like a lightness to his body that he discovered for the first time. And that directly bled into this sort of the dancing and the way that he moves his body, which actually just is kind of artistic just to look at. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but there's something beautiful about his gaunt body, which is weird. I know
it looks
to
like
say,
Tai Chi almost.
Yes.
Or like even like old Bruce Lee movies, which, mm-hmm. But like some of the movements look like Tai Chi. It made me wonder, like, has Joaquin Phoenix been doing Tai Chi? I have a colleague that teaches Tai Chi, mm-hmm. and it looks, I mean, and I've done a little bit of it, but it really looks that way.
Yeah. So yeah, there's definitely that physical aspect. And then the way he laughs, man, he has this laugh in the movie that, and the movie describes it as a condition that he has, that where he actually has a card that he gives to people, but he can't stop laughing. And it's usually at inappropriate times. And then it becomes a physical thing where either the laughter itself chokes him or whether he's trying to hold it back and that's what chokes him, but it usually ends with him choking. And it's like a really unique aspect to his character. And of course, when you think of the Joker, you think of someone who laughs a lot, but this actually grounds it in a very real physical thing where you could imagine him later becoming sort of the full-on Joker and laughing all the time, and you understand that this is where the root of where that comes from. And I thought that was really interesting, and he perfected that laugh with the director, and they actually, like, that was one of the main things he was concerned about before actually accepting the role. He said, I don't know if I can do this because I can't figure out the laugh, and so they went through a bunch of iterations, and I think that's a really haunting aspect to his character as well, which is, again, another physical component to it. But the Joker in general seems to be a role that really brings out the best in every actor, right? So if you think back on all the Jokers we've had on screen, you've got Jack Nicholson, of course, in Tim Burton's Batman, Heath Ledger in Christopher Nolan's Batman, and both of those iconic performances. And I think this one fits right into the mix. So Tim, what do you think, what does Joaquin bring to this Joker that is different from like Jack Nicholson or Heath Ledger's version, would you say?
So I feel like Jack Nicholson was like a theatrical Joker.
Like a showboat, yeah.
Yeah, and like it was like you're watching somebody be the Joker, which actually was a lot better than the original Batman series.
Yeah, I don't
know the Joker's name, but it was Adam West was the
Adam
Batman.
West, yeah.
So I was like, okay, when you got, because that's what we knew. This is a hard thing. All right, let's get into what we talked about over some Mongolian Girl. Okay, so here's the thing. You jerk millennials. I'm tired of hearing you talk about Tim Burton in a bad way.
Okay,
here's my rant right now.
Go.
Because Tim Burton took Batman from the 1960s awful Batman TV show, and he said, no. This is not the aesthetic that we see in DC Comics. We're going to go to the Batman aesthetic. Now, yes, it's not Christopher Nolan. Mm-hmm. Okay. But man, it got us to Christopher Nolan. And yeah. I don't think people like understand how revolutionary that was, because now you look back and you're like, oh, this is just ridiculous.
Well, it's dated now, but going like Kung Pow and all that to this gritty.
There was no onomatopoeia involved. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a totally different Batman. It was a grimy, mm-hmm. you know, shadowy Batman, not some guy wearing, you know, his underwear on the outside of his tights. Mm-hmm. And I think we got to give Tim Burton, and then the idea of, he brings Gotham to life.
Yeah.
Which you didn't have previously.
Huge.
I mean, even some of the art, like look at that original Batmobile, not the original Batmobile, but Tim Burton's Batmobile. I mean,
it was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so as we look at it, I'm just trying to say, have a little perspective, folks.
Yeah.
And realize that like, okay, yes, it's not the Batman it's not the best version of Batman, but it was kind of a step in the process toward that.
Sure. That's
and I'm sure we'll look back at some point and go, oh, though this is not what it should have been either.
Yeah.
But have a little grace on Tim Burton. Tim Burton did a lot for Batman. So anyway, that's my rant.
Beautiful.
I got to say.
Love it.
And I think bring you Jack Nicholson, you know, good choice. And in fact, here's a connection. Mm-hmm. So I heard that Phillips is inspired by One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in this.
Really?
Which starred Jack Nicholson.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's probably three movies, but yeah.
Yeah.
And so the idea of, And that deals with some of the same themes, actually. So, good movie. If you haven't seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest based on a Ken Kesey novel, you should. It's a really good movie. Anyway,
so rant. Jack Nicholson, the kind of a very showy theatrical performance.
Oh, yeah, you're bringing me back to center here. Thank you, John.
That's all right.
All right, so Jack Nicholson, showy. You know, I don't have a lot of comment on Ledger. I think it was really disturbing to people at the time.
Very hardened, like psycho type. Very gritty. And so what's different about Joaquin? What does he bring that those two don't have?
He brings like a desperate desire. I think it's something inside of us. It's this desperate desire to be accepted and loved.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, it's like a very raw, it's very raw and realistic. And if you've spent a lot of time with folks who are dealing with some real severe like personality disorders, or because a lot of us, you know, I want to be more open about this stuff. You know, this is real stuff.
We should be, yeah.
And
it's the first step.
And you know, it's not like you get this diagnosis and then you're we should begin to start talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, like I've known folks that have had personality disorders mm-hmm. in my life, people I love and care about. And he played parts of this were played like with that same desperation of somebody that has a personality disorder to just like, I just want to live life.
Desperation is such a good way to describe it. And empathy. You mentioned that before. I think he brings that the other two don't really have. Yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of felt like he brought more empathy to the than the script brought.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah.
He humanized that figure, even though like the Joker turns out to be maniacal and, maybe that's the wrong term, but he turns out to be homicidal.
Yeah.
I think he does humanize the character up to that point.
And part of it's unfair because the other two roles we just talked about, the whole movie isn't about them. So it's kind of unfair because this whole movie is an empathetic look at the Joker, which is different from what we've seen before.
And it's an origin story, so you get to actually have development rather than just a product.
But I still feel, like you're saying, beyond the script, beyond the framework, what Joaquin actually brings in his eyes, in his physical actions, in his mannerisms, is that sort of desperation
and like, suffering. He looks like he looks like he's suffering the entire movie.
Like I feel if you were to flash forward, like let's say 10 years later we get this sequel that's never going to happen, but let's say we get the sequel where he's actually fighting Batman and he's fully the Joker now, I still feel like you're going to have that same kind of quiet desperation and that same haunting sadness in his eyes, you know?
Yeah. I think the key, one of the key scenes in the movie that kind of shows you who he is that there's the fence. Do you remember this? There's the Wayne's house.
Oh, yeah, where he visits Bruce Wayne as a kid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Bruce Wayne's a little kid, and he's got like a guardian with him. And he can't get to Bruce Wayne, and he can't get into the place that he wants to be the most because he's out. He's on the outs.
That's good.
And so he's like, all he wants to do is find love, and love is on the inside of the fence. But you know what? He can't get to the inside of the fence.
He's like the clown on the outside.
He's the clown on the outside of the fence. And it's kind of like that becomes that metaphor for the character and also for mental illness, which is like, I want to get the love I need, but there's this fence stopping me and it doesn't seem to be stopping a lot of other people.
Mm.
It seems like they come and go through that fence with ease.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I can't get through it.
Yeah.
And so like that, like to me was like really cool. That was the scene for me in this flick.
We should also mention that Robert De Niro is in this as well, and he is great. He plays this like Johnny Carson talk show host dude named Murray Franklin, and he comes through in what's really like the climax of the movie towards the end. So yeah, Robert De Niro, man, you know.
I found him to be a little heavy. I know the casting.
Heavy.
Yeah, because like he's supposed to be like Carson. Carson has like a certain like lovable narcissism to him, and I felt like, and maybe it's just because I've seen De Niro in so many of these roles where he's kind of a heavy and a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like Carson's was like it was kind of more smart ass, and like De Niro's is a little bit more like power, played from a place of power rather than a place of wit.
Interesting.
And so I actually didn't think he did a very good job. That's my personal.
Well, did you not like the way that the character was written, or was it De Niro?
No, I think it's De Niro because they have witty lines for him to do. Like they have comebacks and all that stuff. Now, I understand that you have to make him a little bit mean.
Right, because of what happens in the end, which we won't spoil yet.
Carson could be a little mean. Mm-hmm. You know, my thoughts are like he has to be likable to an audience, but then we have to see a dark side of him. What I saw was he just kind of played like the same old bust your kneecaps kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, and it could be because it's so hard for us to disassociate that from De Niro. But yeah, interesting.
Well, I think part of it, but like also just like in the times where he sounds like he's trying to be warm, I wanted him to be a little more duplicitous so that he would be like so kind to the Joker and then so cruel to him at the same time.
I think I'll have to disagree with you a little bit on that because I feel like he was that they did actually do that when he meets him in the dressing room before they go on together. I feel like there is this sort of this warmth and whatever. What this is going to be great and it's going to be fun. And then once the cameras are turned on, it's sort of like you're a joke. I think they do that, but yeah.
No.
It's all good. What's funny, though, as an aside, is that I was reading this interview, and De Niro's a really old-school actor, and he believes firmly in the read-through. We have to do the read-through before we start filming.
Yeah.
And Joaquin Phoenix firmly does not believe in read-throughs because he wants just the characters to evolve and everything to sort of happen organically throughout the process. And so Todd Phillips was caught in the middle, the director of this old, you know, very powerful Robert De Niro saying, we're doing a read-through because that's what you do. And Joaquin saying, there's no way in heck I'm doing a read-through. Get out of here. And they eventually did the read-through. Because you know it's Robert De Niro, and so apparently they
did Joaquin Phoenix just like go no and hold his ears.
apparently, he was done in De Niro's office.
I can't hear you.
It was done in De Niro's office, and he sort of mumbled his way through the whole thing, and then like immediately left to go smoke, and that was that. And it was like boom, gone. But yeah, it's a very awkward place for a director to be in between two powerful.
I kind of love it
like that, but it's kind of fun. Yeah.
So I guess like yeah, because if Todd Phillips fails. They'll still be acting.
That's true. Oh. Did you ever see The King of Comedy? Because that was one that I haven't seen.
No, I've got to see it now.
Okay, I know,
it seems
right?
It's really critical to like the development of this film.
That's what everyone's saying. But we did see Taxi Driver. We've both seen Taxi Driver, which is definitely something that Phillips has said is a huge inspiration for this.
Yeah, and it's written by, who's the guy that we, was it, he wrote the...
He did the one with Ethan Hawke.
First Reform.
Yeah. I forget his name. But yeah.
So
Traitor.
And in some ways, like if you look at that First Reform film and Taxi Driver and this Joker film, the Joker film's a little bit more over the top.
Yes.
But like all three of those folks devolve.
Yes.
And it's like, you're just watching people unravel.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
And so watching people unravel. Like the act of that is a little bit unnerving that we're doing that for like with popcorn in our hands.
And it feels claustrophobic in all three of those. Right. Exactly.
Right.
Where you're just kind of trapped watching.
So you're like, oh no, he's got to go. You know, like every time. And somebody gets a revolver like in these movies. What's that about? Yeah. So anyway. So I think there is something about it that feels like for me, it feels kind of gross. Mm-hmm. But I have to look at that and go, okay, I'm watching somebody unravel. It feels kind of nasty to watch.
Yeah.
And so that's my feeling about it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's being done well or not. It's just is kind of a nasty experience to watch somebody unravel. Like Taxi Driver, it's a great film, but I always feel gross when I watch it.
Yeah. Well, and part of it is this film, I think, was shot in that same sort of 70s grungy feeling, you know, where it's like the city's dirty and any evil's everywhere and at any moment it's going to jump out and get you. So in that vein, let's talk about the directing a second. So the choice in directors is definitely a little strange. As I already mentioned in the past podcast, Todd Phillips is the director, and he is basically known for raunchy R-rated comedies like Old School and Road Trip and The Hangover.
I love Old School.
You know what? I actually liked Road Trip back in the day when I was in high school. Now I haven't seen it since then, but I thought that was when Tom Green
movie.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I
liked it back then. But anyway, it's probably a terrible film. But the point is that you typically would not pick the R-rated raunchy comedy guy to develop a really serious psychological drama.
Well,
but
didn't Adam McKay just do, he did a bunch of like serious films. And then Farrelly did, what's the one that won Best Picture?
Right, Green Book?
Yeah, that we both don't like.
That was Peter Farrelly.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
I'm going to give you a little counterpoint there, John, saying, yes, McKay. Didn't McKay do Spotlight?
No.
The Big Short.
Yes. He did Vice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are two really serious films that a screwball comedy guy did. So maybe people are like, maybe this is a formula. Mm-hmm. Let's go see. We'll take the who hasn't done. Oh, Phillips. Okay,
there you go.
Yeah, sorry, counterfactual, but that's
I've been noticing it.
The evidence is there.
Yeah,
it's there right now. But like, when have we seen that ever happen before? Never. Like that's a new kind of thing. Is to take a somebody that's just done all comedy and move them into like super serious stuff.
And it works. Apparently, there is a groove of the brain that those two things are can operate out of because we're seeing it left and right. You're right. Yeah.
Weird.
So there was some criticism online, which we'll get to more in depth shortly, but it was basically that Joaquin's performance is great, but the movie itself is just okay. There's a lot of people that have that reaction. What do you think about that? Because that would specifically be Todd Phillips, you know, aspect of this. Do you think Todd Phillips matches the great performance of Joaquin, or is there a letdown there? What do you think?
It was because the performance is so overwhelming. It's very difficult for me to grade the directing.
To parse it out, I know.
On one viewing.
Yeah.
But I will tell you a couple things. It did seem there were parts of it that got stale.
Okay.
I think the editing could have been better. And I don't mean like technically the editing could be better. I mean like they probably should have cut about 5 minutes out of that film that I can think of right now.
Okay.
I think it was a little bit redundant in its motif. I know motif is redundant by nature.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, it was too emphatic. Like, where it could have been more subtle in some of these things.
Sure.
It was like, this is what's happening, everyone. And, like, hits you on the head with the hammer.
Yes.
And then does it four more times. As far as, like, technically, like, I got really tired of slow motion shots of the Joker. Like, I didn't think that was necessary. I think that the character himself could hold the film up. And I think that was like a real, I think it was a device that is something that you lean on when you aren't more creative. Slow motion, 360 degree shots while the flames are burning real slow. You know, that kind of crap is like, wow, that's it, to me, that's total pure cliche. And so and that's the director's job to not let that crap happen. And to me, that happened. And so I don't think he did. I would join the camp, man.
You're in good company, Tim, because that is a popular motif.
Anybody cool say that stuff or just me?
No. There's a lot of,
like
a lot
good
of
reviewers.
Good reviewers. Oh, but there's also a lot of good reviewers that just frankly hate this movie, which we'll talk about in a second.
I think I found what I feel about this movie. I'm externally processing.
Yes.
And it's whatever the cool people say.
But I'm gonna have to disagree with you, because I feel like I really thought Todd Phillips perfectly complimented Joaquin Phoenix, and I actually thought the movie was perfectly paced. I didn't think there was any flab that I would cut. I mean, it's definitely emphatic. I get what you're saying there, especially when they're hammering home like the character motivations. It starts to become a little much. But I think that what I took away from that was that Phillips was actually, like we've already mentioned a couple times, was framing it as we're inside the Joker's head. So of course we're going to have an overabundance of empathy for him, and of course we're going to have a million and one reasons why he's doing the things he's doing. So I feel like because we're in that vantage point, that mise-en-scene is being driven home emphatically because of that. So I think it worked. I mean, if you look at lighting, set pieces, the grunginess of Gotham, you know, that stuff that we talked about, I mean, that's directing, and I thought he brought it home.
And I will give him credit. It's a period piece, and it's pretty good.
Yeah.
From a standpoint of like things look like they were. The suits.
Yes, the look of everything. That's totally director's job.
I was there, you know. Yeah. It's very small, but yes, I was there in Gotham. A fictional place. No.
Right.
No, I can see that.
Yep. And I didn't mind the slow-mo. I thought it worked, and I thought it was beautiful, and it goes with the physicality of what Joaquin is bringing to it, and like him, I could watch him dancing around in that, that sounds so creepy. I mean it in a purely just like...
I understand. I understand what you're saying.
Here we go again. Did my voice crack?
Look, at all I said was I understand, and now... You're going to be all right. You're going to make it through the podcast, John, and we can talk about the feelings later.
All right. So, Tim, I said up front that the movie has been generating polarizing reactions from critics and audiences, and I want us to be able to weigh in here. Okay. So here's what I'm going to do. Let's call this segment Our Reactions to the Reactions. So I'm going to just explain a common reaction that I'm seeing after scouring film Twitter and Facebook and everything and what the people are saying, especially some of these cool critics that we talked about.
I react and you react.
Exactly.
This is so reactionary.
Here we go.
Okay.
Reaction number one. Joker is irresponsible because it depicts a very real type of person in our world today in groups like the incel movement and others where there's like these loners who feel rejected by women or rejected by society and already have this built-in propensity to act out in violent ways and might be triggered by this movie to actually take the next step of committing real violent acts. And for that reason, this movie should never have been made. What is your reaction to that, Tim?
Oh, let's burn books after that. Ah. that's my one sentence reaction. Are we going to, that's just, to me, is exactly the problem,
mm-hmm.
which is like, you really want to censor art because somebody might react to it.
Right.
Now, I understand that we can have deep concern, but I think art is supposed to provoke things.
That's it.
Now, that said, like I get that people have a lot of fear associated with Batman movies because there have been people who have basically appropriated that format or this narrative to do horrible things.
That's right. It has happened. And it's totally understandable. It's a valid concern, right? I mean, the movie definitely depicts a guy who's forsaken by society and then gets noticed through violence and gets the power that he wants, gets the attention that he wants. So you could see that appealing. You could see like...
And there's other narratives that are like that too, that where people misappropriate a narrative and then go on crusade. Right?
Right. I mean, like
our narrative?
Right? The Christians.
And kill a bunch of people.
Right. So are we going to ban the Bible because it's been misused in the Crusades? Good point.
Yeah.
Charles Manson, you know, referenced Helter Skelter. Are we going to throw away the White Album? At what point? Even Taxi Driver. We talked about Taxi Driver. The dude who shot Reagan said he was influenced by Hinckley or whatever. Said he was influenced by Taxi Driver. So,
or I mean, there's a whole number of things. And then let's not even talk about Catcher in the Rye. But but there's a whole number of things where people have blamed art for homicide.
Right.
Which I think is a pretty big jump. But it does tell us something about our culture, right?
Yes.
We're trying to find something to blame. And maybe there is a problem. Maybe it's not the Joker movie that's to blame. Maybe it's something else.
Right.
Not providing an answer, but just saying, not saying that there isn't fear. Mm-hmm. There is fear.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's to ban art is not the way to deal with it.
So legitimate concern, but the going as far as saying the movie shouldn't have been made is getting into that censorship territory, which we don't want to go down. Yeah.
It's one thing to yell fire in a movie theater and another thing to yell a movie in the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a movie. This is not yelling fire in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. So I think that's unjustified in my opinion.
And the only other thing I'd say on that is that the role of art is to like depict a character and a viewpoint, right? And if you hear about like actors talking about how they get into character, they basically say, okay, I need to basically, whatever this character believes or whatever their worldview is, that needs to become me while I'm acting. And it's the same thing with a movie. Like you're presenting this character, this viewpoint, and that may not be a moral viewpoint. In fact, it may be bleak and horrifying, but in this frame of reference, this is what we're presenting. And I feel like there are real people that think like this, that act like this, and that it's valid to represent that type of person so that we can begin to understand them, empathize with them, and maybe stop something in real life from happening. So I think it's valid. Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard. It's hard. It's a hard one to walk. Yeah.
And people have been debating this about art for a long time.
Yeah.
But on the press junket, it's a question Joaquin Phoenix is getting asked a lot, and his most common reaction is to just sort of walk out of the interview. But, I mean, it's tough, right? I mean, like, you're just trying to...
He's an actor playing a character.
Right, right.
I mean, that's the reality of that.
Yeah.
And
he's being asked, like, what are you going to say right now to the victims of gun violence? And he's just like, what are you talking about?
What? I'm an actor playing a character.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Reaction number two.
We want to blame somebody.
Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead. No, reaction number two.
Reaction number two. This really is just a lot of talk about nothing because the movie isn't actually all that interesting. It's derivative of a bunch of better movies, and it's shallow in its explanations of the character. And at the end of the day, it's not even that good of a movie. So why are we even wasting time talking about it? And I've heard this from a few critics I really, really respect, including Alyssa Wilkinson over at Vox. I love her take on movies. And this is her basic reaction, is that this is a shallow movie that isn't that great, and we're just kind of wasting time even having it be a controversy because it's not that great. What would you say to that?
There's merit in that. It is derivative. So? Yeah. But a lot of things, I would say like a lot of things are, like the things that we might call homage might also be called derivative.
Tarantino built a whole career off derivative.
Yeah. I mean, so he pays homage and it becomes homage, right?
Uh-huh.
And now it's... But if we, like, yeah, and I don't think anybody's trying to, like, cover up that these have, you know, that this is.
Todd Phillips has been open about it in interviews, what inspired him. And
those are better movies, probably. So what's the third one? So it's Cuckoo's Nest, the one we just mentioned.
Taxi Driver.
Oh, no, it's those three. They're all three are better movies.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think, I don't think that's wrong.
That's fine. But here's what I will say. I will say that I think The Joker is a better movie than The Dark Knight. And because I recently rewatched Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, and I think that movie is a mess that is completely overshadowed by the fact that Heath Ledger is amazing in it. I think that solely makes up in people's minds for the total dropping the ball of the execution of that movie. But honestly, that movie's a hot mess.
Really? And you love him.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. But Heath Ledger's fantastic, of course. Anyway,
That might be a legitimate critique. I'll have to think about that.
I disagree. I think they're wrong. I think this is a very good movie. I think it is interesting. It's exceptional art, and therefore, I think it's worth talking about. Sorry.
I think, so here's a little thing I know about you. Okay. When you feel emotionally moved, you will react to a movie a little stronger than normal.
That's true.
So it's not saying like you'll tend to say if you're emotionally moved, you'll tend to notch it a little bit higher aesthetically.
Sure.
I have a problem with that. That's like in your review, like it's a part of your review process.
If a movie hits me straight in the heart, then I'm all in.
And this hits you in the heart.
It did.
There was something about it that drew you into the character. Yeah.
But you know, you have critics online, like the New Yorker. The New Yorker, Tim. Literally is saying, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's not far off.
There's no other way to do it.
Saying something like, oh, he was abused as a child. People don't like him. Poor little clownsy wounsy. I guess he has to go kill some people. That's the New Yorker, right? Just like totally blasting the film as being totally shallow and just... I don't know. I just don't agree. I think it's really... There's more nuance there than people are giving it credit for, and I think it's a really well-executed film. But my opinion. Of course. We're all just sharing our opinions.
I like that. I like that. This reacting to quotes, it may be fruitful.
All right. Finally, reaction number three. You ready? You see, this is what we've been saying all along. It's mental illness that's the problem, not guns.
Geez.
What would you say to that?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
One of the things that drives me up a wall here is... that base is like when we look at the Joker as like just a guy who represents all of mental illness, it looks like to be mentally ill is to be violent, which is just not true.
Gotcha. So like just whittling everything into, oh, everyone who commits an act like this must be mentally ill is completely
Just not true. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Like to be mentally ill is not to be violent. There's not an equal sign right there. But I think that there's many people that want to paint it that way.
Uh-huh.
The gun lobby, right?
Yeah.
Wants to paint it like, okay, if you're mentally ill, you're crazy. If you're mentally ill, then you're violent, which is just not true. Like that's just not true. And so, but it's an easy way to blame people who are very vulnerable and then take the blame off of yourself.
Easy way to do nothing.
Well, yeah, an easy way to do nothing.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that there, of course, there are people who are mentally ill who are violent.
Right.
And there are people who are just violent.
Exactly.
Right. And so I think that that's a, yeah, I don't think that's a very good point, to be honest with you.
And I guess one of my reactions would be that, you know, and this is a spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie, I don't know what you're doing, go see the movie, come back. But there is also the fact that if Joaquin Phoenix hadn't been able to bring a gun onto the set of Murray's show, he might still be alive, right? So, you know, maybe invest in some form of metal detectors or something like that. So I guess in the movie...
Well, I looked at the gun from a different perspective.
Okay.
Like if he didn't have... Somebody hadn't given him a gun... He would never become the Joker.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
So like, yeah. So somebody gives him the gun because the idea is like, oh, you need to protect yourself. You're going to need this thing.
Yeah.
And in reality, the possession of that gun ended up changing.
That becomes the catalyst for him becoming the Joker.
It becomes the catalyst for the Joker.
Yeah.
And it aids in the descent, it doesn't prevent it. And so to me, like that's a problem.
Interesting. No, that's really good.
So I don't think that the filmmaker's advocating. I think the filmmaker would say, like, hey, we introducing guns into the situation is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly.
Clearly.
But I don't think that the problem, it doesn't, it's not painted like the problem is mental illness, or it's saying, like, you know, maybe a gun does contribute to some of these things.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's, of course, we know both of those can be factors, and right, it's not one or the other.
And it's just, yeah, and this is a character,
right?
And yeah, so we have to be careful. And what you know, I might have said this before, but we don't want to just take this and go, oh, this is saying this about all things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've talked to me about, you know, Joaquin's Phoenix's reaction. It's like, no, I'm just acting a character. I'm doing a character analysis here.
Yep.
And I'm acting, and I'm trying to, like, kind of react to what this character would really do.
And putting it all on the shoulders of the Joker might be.
Yeah, but, like, taking, you know, everyone that has, that's dealing with something, you know, mental illness in some way, and, like, putting it on this character is probably not very fair.
Yeah.
To the filmmaker, to the film. And I know, you know, that's the temptation, right?
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. So let's shift our attention to some of the themes that we see in Joker. Tim, what are the main themes that stood out to you?
Like, one of them would be, like, social contract. I don't know. Have you heard of that before?
Mm-mm.
So there's this idea that comes out of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and John Locke, basically Enlightenment thinkers,
okay,
that there is an unwritten contract between people who govern the society and the people being governed. And if that contract, and it's in any society, and if that contract is broken, mm-hmm, the people, you know, from the leadership or those who are governing, if they don't govern by a certain standard based on that social contract, then the people have the right to rebel against those folks.
Hmm. Okay. Violently or?
I mean, I think violently or whatever would change for, anyway, whatever it would take to change it, to renegotiate the social contract.
Okay.
So that the social contract gets renegotiated via violence or via uprising.
Hmm.
Which I think, you know, as much as we don't like that idea, it's not untrue, like, historically.
Right. Like, if the leaders that were supposed to be looking out for us, that we have entrusted, break that, like, the contract, what you're saying, then it's, like, the duty of the people to stand up and say, hey, right?
So what's terrifying,
uh-huh,
and now we're getting into contemporary politics, because, you know, so you see that in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You see social contract, and the idea is, like, well, we have the right to rebel if we're basically the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer,
mm-hmm,
and it's working for some people, but it's not working for the majority of people, then we have the right to do something about that,
mm-hmm,
and to go out in full, like, in the streets and rebel. I mean, that's not a new idea.
Right.
That's the French Revolution, right?
Or the American Revolution.
Or the American Revolution, right? And it can go across political systems too.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is very dangerous, because people go, oh, that's a dangerous idea. What's a really dangerous idea is if the social contract is being breached and the people do nothing.
Hmm.
And so that's one of the things that we're looking at right now. I think of, like, our current president,
yeah,
and the fact that people aren't reacting to clear accusations. I mean, it's not that they're not being proven or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going through impeachment or whatever,
mm-hmm,
that process. It's that people don't even react to it anymore.
Yeah. Either, like, you have one group of people that either throws up their hands and go, ugh, politics, or all politicians are corrupt, right? Which,
right,
is just total inaction. Or even what I was thinking when you're saying that is that, like, there's even entire systems that keep you from being able to do anything. Like, gerrymandering makes it so that your vote doesn't even count if you want it to count. So voting them out doesn't even work, right?
Yeah. And
yeah.
So, you know, that's democracy. But what I would say is, like, within this theory, like, with social contract, I would say, no, it doesn't even. You know, the vote doesn't is if the vote is being nullified, then you've basically violated the terms of representative democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now it's like, it's not just like that it could happen and that it should happen. It's that no, your duty is to actually go against the government.
Yeah.
And so that's a pretty wild idea.
Interesting.
And so, but the threat, and I think I talked about this in the previous podcast about de Tocqueville. I know, mm-hmm, we're getting into, like, political philosophy here.
Got to rename the show.
We should. Cinema, faith, and political philosophy.
Politics.
Yeah. but the philosophy behind that de Tocqueville would say is that he thought was a really danger to democracy is this individualism. And so individualism would say, like, that your few friends that you hang out with or people that are in your social network or whatever, that you'd begin to think that they represent the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that that little world is the only thing that matters to you. And so that's a big threat, because if the social contract could be broken, but it's not threatening that world.
Yes.
Then you have no, and you don't believe in, you know, and you don't see it or don't feel it. Even if you're poor or if you're rich, then you may not feel like you have the duty to rebel or the duty to renegotiate the social contract. Anyway, no, all this said,
awesome. Yeah, that's really
all this said, that's a theory. I mean, that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing why is the Joker empowered? It's because people are feeling like the social contract has been breached.
Coupled with the fact that there is a certain class of society that is very easy to cut off from social funding, from, you know, when it's time to get fiscally conservative on the budget, there it's very easy to cut funding to certain people that have real consequences for them, right? We see in the film that
we got plenty of money in all the other categories, but this was an easy one to cut. Yeah, because and this would, let's look at social contract again, which is say those governing would be the first thing that you, that where they would breach would be the people that don't have the ability to renegotiate the social contract.
Yeah.
So if there's something, so if the government, you take the most vulnerable people, and those would be the people that were going to feel it first. And so if we're talking about mental illness, that's what we're talking about.
Yep.
And you know, yeah.
And that has really, it has a real effect on the Joker character in the film, because even he's going to that counselor, right? Who doesn't listen to him half the time.
Yeah. Doesn't, he's not even a great counselor, like a social worker type. Yeah. Which is not bad to social workers. It's just not like they're not a therapist.
Yeah. But that even that little thing that he has to go to keeps him on his medication, and it actually keeps him at some sort of baseline.
And he keeps a journal, even though it might be totally
terrible.
Yeah, terrible. You get glimpses of it.
Right.
But it's keeping him at some place. Yeah, like at a baseline.
Right.
And then he loses that.
Yep. Because the funding's cut.
And his eight medications all at once.
Yep.
Woo.
Eight medications.
That's not a good thing.
No. So one of the big takeaways too for me was that kind of this idea that we need, that we have these legitimate problems like we've just been talking about, but we need to have, we need to think about what is our answer, right? So as Christians, like, we don't believe that violence is an option. We don't believe that doing nothing is an option. So what is our option as Christians? And I would say that that would be cruciform love, right? So you have this character in Arthur who has some really legitimate diagnosis of what's going wrong with society. One of the best lines in the movie, when it comes really early, it's, is it me or is it getting crazier out there? Right? That happens very good at the beginning of the movie. And we live in this world with, like we said, massive income inequality. There are people with money and power are holding all the keys. There are whole neighborhoods of people who literally cannot pull themselves up by their bootstraps because there are no bootstraps, right?
Yeah.
And so what is the answer? What do we believe? Why are we Christians? What do we believe is the answer to this? And I feel like Arthur does what is natural for him to do, which is resort to desperate violence, right? But the problem with violence is that it's like a cancer. It just keeps begetting violence, begets violence, begets violence. I saw the movie again today with my wife, and she noticed that in that one scene, it's right after the whole thing happens with Murray. There's this big bunch of screens that they're kind of pulling away, and you see all these different images of what just happened. And in the bottom corner, there's the Energizer Bunny, right? It's just going and going and going, and violence just keeps going and going and going, which is one of the problems with it, right?
Yeah, and I took that a little bit differently. I mean, it may just be compounded, but like, I took it to be like the media feeds off of the violence.
Oh, like the reaction from the media just keeps.
Yeah, it just like snowballs, and you get, and like the it was like the screens were feeding on it.
Oh, that's nice.
And so, it's like, so this is where it's the conflict rather than like the where the conflict is coming from.
Interesting. No, I like that. That's great. Awesome. So yeah, and this, so the violence, the problem with violence is it just keeps going and going. And so so what's the answer? And I feel like the answer is kind of summed up in Arthur's girlfriend, who we of course later find out, spoiler alert, didn't actually exist. But that's what he's looking for. He's looking for a connection. He's with someone who will love him unconditionally. And that is what he expresses in his most vulnerable moments. You see it when he is imagining being hugged by Murray, when he's talking to Thomas Wayne and he's just like, you know, I don't know why everyone's mean to each other. I just want a hug. It's what he literally says. And so that to me is what Arthur truly needs. And that is what we as Christians believe is the actual answer. It's what changes people. Love expressed in our politics and what we vote for, but also in how we treat our neighbor every day. And so, I don't know, just keeping that in perspective, we have the legitimate problems and what is our solution to it? It's not violence. It's not inaction. It's love in action. So, yeah. Hmm. All right, Tim, as we begin to wrap things up here, if you had to list your favorite moments from the movie, do you have like one or two like favorite moments?
Yeah. So I don't know if I mentioned it yet, but there's one with the gate or
the fence.
Yeah. The fence. Yep. Did I mention that already? That? Yep. And then the other one. So there's subtle things in the movie. There's one scene where he's on the bed, like his mom is in the hospital or she passed. I don't remember which one.
Uh-huh.
And above the bed is Mary and the Christ child.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not see that at all.
It's above the bed.
Wow.
And it's like, and he sleeps next to his mother. But the idea being like she's kind of been beatified by him, right?
Uh-huh.
But that there was a certain desperate, it's like, where did she go? And then he's also searching for the father too, right?
Mm-hmm. That betrayal that we kind of see that he has with her, yeah.
But it puts him in like this, I mean, just having him there and then some of the, you know, you talked about some of the other scenes where there is like this, like they are drawing on that kind of the Christa, you know, cruciform images and like this, oh yeah, they're going to put him in these Christ, which makes sense because of the films that this has come from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some overt times, that's one of them. So I think about that one. And then also, I think there's one that we both talked about, which is the staircase.
Yeah, the staircase metaphor. I love that. Yeah. He's first half of the film, he just keeps like, he's like trudging upstairs. And then second half, he's dancing downstairs. Right.
Yeah. So like one's like he's enjoying the descent.
Yeah.
And it's representing his own sanity.
Right.
And the other one, it's like to be sane takes all this work.
Mm. Following the rules. And getting nothing from it.
And you get nothing, but like to let go and to just yield is like a dance.
Yeah.
And the other one is like a mountain climb.
Especially when you're dealing with mental illness and society that's basically giving you no hope.
Yeah.
I had a ton. If I had to narrow it down, I would say, first of all, like we're talking about with Arthur trying to follow the rules, there's some scenes where he's just in total bewilderment over why, like, the world is just getting crazier and crazier. My favorite moment with that is when he gets jumped by these kids, they take a sign, they steal it, and then his boss calls him in his office and says, hey, you know, you obviously stole the sign, just give it back. And Arthur just looks at him with this, like, just total confusion, like, why would I steal a sign? And it's like mixed with that haunting sadness. You like almost a tear starts forming, right? But also a smile, which is like, right.
And it's completely rational.
Yeah.
That's what's weird about that scene.
Yeah.
So he's completely rational and the boss is not being rational.
Right.
Who has the power?
Exactly.
The boss. Yeah.
That's so good.
And he loses the job.
Yep. There's also that whole scene in the apartment where he's like, he's dyeing his hair green and then the coworkers come over and there's that violent act that happens and the whole thing with the little person who can't reach the knob on the door. And it just, I think that whole scene is executed perfectly with the tension and it really leaves a mark.
And it's like, and it's a metaphor again, right?
What do you mean?
So like the little man, like, gets away because he's been good to the Joker, right?
Oh,
and then the fat man doesn't.
Right. The bigger guy represents the man, you're saying?
Yeah, like, well, he's, like, domineering. He's
lies.
He lies. Yeah. He does all these other things. And then the little guy is, like, he's also, like, also persecuted, but in a different way.
Oh, yeah.
Than Arthur is.
Yeah.
But they're both, but he's been good to Arthur, so he lets him go. He's always been good to me.
And he, like, kisses him on the forehead.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter, like, you know, your logic would say, like, murder him because he saw you murder the other guy.
And you're going to get caught, right? And he doesn't even care about that.
And no, he's like, no, you're one, you know, you've been good to me. And, you know, so he lets the little guy go.
Huh.
And he actively lets him go because he unlatches the door, the chain.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, yes, obviously he's a little person.
I didn't think about that. That's so great. That's a great metaphor.
So anyway, it's a different, it's just kind of reiterating that theme.
And then finally, the one scene that I can't get in my head is that whole sequence at the end when in the studio with Murray. I just think every minute of that is executed to perfection, and it sticks the landing, which is really important to me. Movies have to end well. Make sure you're leading up to something. Make sure you're leading up to something and that you deliver that one final punch, and that's what this movie does for me. And so, boom, those would be my top three moments. All right, Tim, this is it, man. Your final thoughts on Joker and your letter grade. Go.
I think it was a beautiful performance by Joaquin Phoenix. And I think the directing was par. So which I wouldn't give an A to. I'd give a B.
Okay.
A gentleman's B to the directing and cinematography. It's a good film. Go see it if you can. It's always like a lot of these films is going to be better in a large format. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to see it eventually, see it now and go check it out. Now, I wouldn't give it an A. But I would say the performance is an A.
The performance is A. The overall film, you give it a B.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel comfortable doing that.
Okay. Well, I thought this movie was a masterpiece. I really did.
Surprising.
I mean, it works as a comic book movie, right? Like, if you want, it's unique. It's one of the best of its class. And it's honestly actually kind of a shame that they're probably never going to make a straight-up sequel to this because, you know, it's Joaquin Phoenix has artistic integrity, and there's no freaking way that they're going to show up and presenting him fighting Batman, and he's going to want to do it, which is fine. That's great.
Come on, man.
This is how it should be.
I'm just saying. Bale Phoenix.
Oh my gosh. Can you even imagine that?
Bale Phoenix. That's a good name for a band. Yeah. So
I know.
You want Batman and the Joker to fight.
It would be amazing. But I just think the way they set up that whole like Bruce Wayne thing with him like as a little kid and then doing the smile, it's like so perfect. You want to see them 20 years later like fighting, you know, but it's never going to happen. It's fine. I'm just saying that it's a great setup as a comic movie, but it even works as just a regular psychological drama. Just take Gotham out and throw in Chicago and you still have a perfect character study. It's amazing. And like you said, Joaquin is stunning performance. He's going to get an Oscar nom. That is for sure. Will he win? It's very possible. We haven't seen all the performances, but he's already at the top of the list as far as what we've seen right now.
I think he'll be in the mix.
No, totally.
I don't see how you can't. I mean, exactly. Look at the, like, when you look at that performance, and especially, one of the other scenes I didn't mention was like, he's in the clown locker room. And he's all curled up and twisted and he's beat up.
The back.
And just he's like, alone and all we see is his back.
Yeah.
Like there's all these scenes where all we can see is the back. We can't see how he's feeling. And I think that's intentional.
Yeah.
It's like, no, we don't. We only see a little bit of who he really is. And the other part is inaccessible to us. Yeah. I think that's intentional. Like that's part of the deal. But when he's all twisted and he's beat up and he's being mocked by clowns and like this, it's very powerful acting.
Yeah.
And the way he's doing it and the awkward movements he makes, and he looks like he's in pain every time he moves any muscle. I mean, that's just amazing performance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't see a lot of movies where I feel like the acting overshadows the movie. I know you do a lot because you're more sensitive to the acting part. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is one of them.
Yeah, for sure. So this movie, I'm giving a straight A. I think it's a perfect film. It is sliding in at number 2 on my top 10 of the year. Number 1, still, Last Black Man in San Francisco. If you haven't seen it, it is now available on Amazon. Spend $4. Rent this movie. It is so good.
What a deal, man.
Exactly.
And you could bring it like 100 friends in your living room.
Yes. And it is still, it's the best movie I have seen since Moonlight. So you're talking 2016. It's the best.
I like Roma.
Yeah, I know. You love Roma.
I got a Roma.
I like Roma too, but I just think this is the best movie I've seen in a few years. So, but yeah, so that's number 1. But number 2, I am sliding in Joker, number 2. So there you go. Straight A.
Wow.
Perfect film.
Wow.
Boom. All right, Tim, there you have it, man. We have weighed in. Everyone has an opinion about this movie. Hey, if you want to share your opinion with us, we have an email address. It is podcast@cinemafaith.com. One more time, podcast@cinemafaith.com. Listen to this. We will read your email on the air. So send us your thoughts. If you haven't yet, you know, we're doing our best, but we're not perfect. We've got, right?
We're open to like change and learning and artistic. Like we want to hear if we misinterpreted the film.
Yes.
If we took a perspective that maybe wasn't what, you know, maybe we could learn something.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is a sensitive subject and neither John and I are real experts in this.
No.
We had, you know, we are limited. And so if you maybe have something to add that we're not afraid. Like, we don't have fear of, like, hearing new ideas that might and to go, oh, I was wrong.
Yep.
That's like the climate we want to be in here, okay?
And we will read your review on the air. How many podcasts can say that? You think Ira Glass is going to read your review on the air?
If it's really good, well, he might make a show out of it. Okay. And get paid.
Bad example.
But we're not like that. We don't get paid. And so, no, but if you got something to say, we want to hear it.
Yes.
It's important to us. And yeah.
And if you haven't yet, please also rate and review the show on iTunes and the Apple Podcast app. Literally, guys, it takes 30 seconds. It would be so helpful. You just say, love the show. Give us a little rating. Have you heard anything from anyone? We haven't heard anything since our last podcast.
All right. So people do listen.
Okay.
That's what the robot.
You got something.
Well, we were eating some food and the robots. Somebody gave us, Dan gave us some robot report or something. Anyway, this is what happens when we go out to eat food. Not just Dan says people are listening. Also, my friend Bo is listening.
Hi, Bo. Thank you for listening. Fantastic. What do you say?
He's a good friend, an old friend. And he says he watched Mandy.
Oh my gosh.
And he also says he was scared to watch it after the podcast.
Good reason.
But he also realized because of the podcast, he looked it up, that it got really good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? He loved it.
He loved it.
He loved it. And he texted me and he said, I might be a bad person though. And I don't think Bo is a bad person. I'm not saying go watch Mandy, but I'm saying, like, you know what? Maybe some of our reviews could expand your love for cinema.
So he liked the movie and he thought maybe he was a bad person because he liked it. I understand that reaction. Totally.
I understand too.
That's basically
you dragged me to it.
I know.
I blame you mostly.
I know.
So now you got yourself and me on your conscience.
Yes.
But the point is, and Bo. Yeah, that's true, and Bo. But yeah, I think Bo's the kind of guy that if you say don't do something, he's going to go run and go do
it. Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Which is, you know, one of the reasons I love the guy.
Well, thank you for the feedback, Bo. That's fantastic.
Thank you, Bo.
Awesome.
But yeah, so I would say if you want to give us some feedback, however you can get it to us, you know, carrier pigeon or...
We'll take it anyway.
Submarines or whatever it takes. We're here. The easy way would go would be the email, right?
Yeah. It'd be the easy thing. Carrier pigeon, I think that would be generally easier.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to train just to send an email than train pigeons
Then
remove them from their home
in the hopes
that they will fly back. yeah, I understand. Okay. All right. So,
all right, Tim, as far as next month is concerned, I am hoping that we'll be able to podcast on this movie called The Irishman.
Martin Scorsese
has a new movie coming out. Apparently, it's very good. It's been making the festival rounds. Mob movie. De Niro, Pesci's in it.
What?
Maybe Al Pacino. I don't know. It's 3.5 hours long, which is crazy, but apparently it is his best movie in years and it's amazing. So that is coming out next month. And it's a Netflix film. It's actually a Netflix film this time because last podcast we thought Booksmart was and then it wasn't. This is actually a Netflix film, which means that it is going to have a limited release and it's actually then going to appear on Netflix at the end of November.
Like Roma.
Right, exactly.
So where
comes out in a few theaters.
So you saw it in the theater. I waited too long and saw it on Netflix.
Dude, it was so good. And that was a theater movie too because of just how beautiful the black and... Wasn't black and white.
Yes, it was.
Okay, and thank you.
And don't talk about it anymore. I'm jealous.
It was great. Yeah. So yes, so we will try to catch The Irishman if you're game.
I'm so game. Scorsese, come on. I mean, he's like overtly Catholic director. You don't get much of that anymore, right?
There you go.
Like, he's very openly Catholic.
He is.
I love it.
He is.
So
awesome.
he'll bring that into the film. He's not apologetic. I love it.
Perfect. Well, that is the plan. Until then, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.